Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
I don't know about you, Liam, but it is hot. It's getting warm and I am thirsty. How about you?
It's very warm. I am thirsty and I sort of just alluded to it earlier. Double parked here.
Doesn't look like you're going to be thirsty for long.
No, I'm not. I know over the last couple of weeks, I promised that I was going to do a couple of brews and get them kegged and whatnot. I managed to get them kegged last week.
Yep. And did you do the keg roll to carbonate them?
I did because I wanted a beer. Actually, so that was on Saturday. I got around to it and I was going to have a beer on Saturday night, but I did the Sydney to Gong Ride on Sunday. So I thought, no, I better not have the beers the night before.
Yeah.
So even though I really forced the carbonation, I didn't actually benefit from it.
Yeah.
Then did the ride on Sunday and we went and saw the Book of Mormon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What did you think?
It was good. I've seen it before, but it was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Saw it when it was out last time and I just keep forgetting. Like, you just forget a lot about it, a lot of it. And so it was good to see. So long story short, I didn't get to drink any of my beers on Sunday night. Monday, just shit got in the way. Couldn't get that done. And then last night, so tonight is the first time and I am yet to taste either of them.
Yeah. So you've got two very different looking beers there. Why don't you talk me through what they are?
This first one in the tall glass, quite cloudy because, you know, I don't have a filter. I don't use any fining agents. I cold crash the fermenter and just help get everything settled out. And then I rack it off into a second fermenter to help settle it again.
Right.
But I don't filter it. And so this first one's the Australian Pale.
Yeah. Which, it's a great color.
It's a great color. The carbonation looks good. And I was quite happy when the other one poured, it didn't seem like it held the carbonation as well. It's good, but it's gone way over the top on the bitterness.
Oh, really? What hops did you put in it?
That was a Galaxy, I think.
Galaxy made it bitter.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Well, don't forget with the hops, you know, hops serves two purposes in the beer, right? One is bitterness and the other one is flavor. And then, three purposes. Bitterness, flavor, and then aroma.
Yeah. But I generally don't find I get bitterness from Galaxy. It just makes it fruity.
This one's really hit the bitterness.
Interesting. Mm. Is it bitterness or sourness? Is it?
No, it's quite bitter.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Just have to note that. Make sure I don't put so much in that first hop addition. But then the other
one. Do you keep a notebook? Do you like keep a record of all your brews?
No, I'm not that organized.
Yeah.
I should.
I've got an app. And it's free.
Beersmith?
Yeah. I didn't make it. I actually did make an app.
No, there's one out called Beersmith, which I've got and I use.
Yeah, so Beersmith is the one that integrates with is it the Grandfather or is it one of the other ones?
I'm not
the Hopzilla. I can't remember. Well, this one's called Brew Tracker and it's free and it's just standalone and it's just completely works offline. You can export your data to CSV if you want to back up. Yeah, I just use that. And like I've never backed up or exported because it's in your AMP data folder on your device, which is backed up by your device OS if you use your...
Yeah, okay.
Your OS is cloud backup. Sorry?
I'll have a look at it.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. It's a bit disappointing. So, don't know what I can do to fix that.
The bitterness?
Oh, it's a bit...
don't know.
And then this one is the Irish Red.
Yeah.
Which is quite dark. Yeah. Like I said, it hasn't held the carbonation.
No.
That's a lot better.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Looks like it might be similar to maybe Kilkenny or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, similar. It's just still a bit cloudy because, as I said, it's not fully filtered. But no, I think that one will go down well. The other one I'll give to my enemies.
Yeah.
No, it's all right. You can get through it, I guess. Anyway, that's enough about my beers. What are you drinking?
I am drinking an Australian Pale Ale that I also brewed. This one is and I'm not sure if I've had this one before, but it was certainly on the show, but I've certainly spoken about it. This is the one that I brewed with Riley a few weeks ago.
You did speak about it, yes.
Yeah, and it's really good. So there was two that we made. There was this one and the lager. The lager also, I can't get it to carbonate, and I think I've probably got a failed seal on the keg, so I probably just need to replace the seal. hopefully on the keg and not on the quick connect. But yeah, and also it is quite good, the lager, but it has got a little bit of sourness to it. So I think it probably needs just a little bit more yeast chucked in for a week or so. I don't know. But this one came out really good. So this one is the pale ale. This one is, so it was hopped with Citra, and then I added Galaxy as a finishing hop.
Yeah, okay.
So, and yeah, it's good. Got a great, great smell. And this one's nicely carbonated, and it's just got a nice crisp, fruity flavor, and it's refreshing. It's good.
It's nice and clean.
Mm. So same thing. So I also don't filter. I just cold crash. I don't do a second fermenter, so I cold crash in the main fermenter, and then I just kind of decant it into the keg, and then.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. But you don't go from all grain, do you?
No.
I think that's also where the cloudiness comes from, the extra grains.
So speaking of this app that I mentioned, this Brew Tracker app, and I did mention that it has got like offline data, it stores the data offline.
Yep.
So you might think that a great candidate for that would be something like Cabinet that we mentioned on the last episode.
Yes. Yep.
I thought it'd be good to follow up on that one. I since discovered that the problem that I had was actually nothing to do with LightDB, and it was a completely unrelated problem that I still had, and I now fixed it, and it now works with LightDB. And Cabinet, like, it still works, but yeah, that was a good waste of time.
That's always the case, but...
But it was an interesting experiment.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, you get to learning things like that, and learning by experience and experimentation. I think it's all part of the fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what else is interesting is I literally only just thought of this, but talking through that last episode and thinking about what I was doing with that, there was so much that we spoke about around benchmarking and performance and optimization. Yeah. And pretty much every episode up to now, I've said that's not something I ever really care about, because we don't need to now, because we're spoiled with the hardware and specs that we've got. And, you know, there I was eking out milliseconds.
Yeah, no, I get that. I really get that, but I think this is different.
How so?
I really think this is different. Your infrastructure layer code that talks to the bare metal needs to be optimized. I mean, less so these days, less so because we're not using spinning platters, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I don't disagree. Yeah, but though I don't disagree, but I'm not writing that code. You know, I'm not writing C or assembler.
No, but you're at that infrastructure layer that's hitting the... That is reading and writing those bytes.
That's true. Yeah.
Right? So making sure that is optimized is extremely beneficial.
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason why, you know, if you think about a lot of, well, going back to really early days, one of the biggest or two of the biggest bottlenecks when you're writing any kind of application, even desktop application, well, one of them was file access.
Yeah.
Right. You've always got to be protective around, you know, that's where one of the main times you're using your try catches and making sure shit just happens as you expect, because there's a lot that happens that's under the covers, right? That you don't know about from the application level.
Yep.
The other one would be sort of the network side. And then you combine those two and you're talking sort of database type connections.
Yeah.
Right. And I guess maybe I'm showing my age there, but, you know, in that space sort of database files, you always needed to make sure that you're extremely defensive.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that you're not having unnecessary reads and writes in that space, because they can notoriously be slow.
Yeah, it's expensive. And it's interesting because if you look at Cabinet and you look at the benchmarks that I've got in there and the code that I've got for the benchmarking and how I've... And it's like you said, right? So it's, you know, I'm not really talking directly to the bare metal in my code, but I am buffering byte arrays and... I am buffering reads and writes to disk. And if you look at the code, the IO bottleneck is the read and write.
Yep.
And interestingly, I did toy with a few ideas of potentially splitting that across multiple threads, but really you can't, because it's a database. It's got to be thread safe. So you've got to have a lock. So
somewhere
depends on
where you put the lock.
It does. And yes. And also this is, yes, it's not a database as I labored the point, but it's a single user scenario as well. So there's probably things you can get away with, but also, like, you know, the performance was, I was very happy with it. It was good. It was a good experiment and it worked out really well. And I was really happy with the result. It just turned out to be completely unnecessary.
Oh, fun thought experiments.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of fun, fun thought experiments.
Yeah.
This is nothing to do with fun thought experiments, so I don't know where I was going with that. But in terms of following up on things that we covered or intended to cover in the last episode, we did say we were going to do our big reveal of the AdaConf winner.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Yeah, and we didn't, because we were waiting to get in touch with that individual, and now we have, and he has his tickets.
Awesome. Do you care to share who was the lucky recipient?
So congratulations to the winner of the BDD plus AdaConf ticket giveaway 2025, Pavel Dvorak. Congratulations. Well
done. Congratulations. Is this where we put like an overlay of cheering?
Yeah, we will. Yeah, and probably some glass clinks and cheers. So really happy that we had a winner there. And of course, we can congratulate Pavel in person next week.
Yeah, can't wait to have a drink with you, AdaConf, Pavel.
Yeah, that'll be good. Yeah. Remind me, what day are you heading down? Thursday, is it?
Thursday.
Yeah. What sort of time?
I think I leave Sydney mid-afternoon, maybe 2. Yeah. So okay. I probably won't be Melbourne CBD till closer to 5.
Yeah.
Really, when all said and done.
Okay.
Just in time for beers.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do have a commitment that evening, but we can definitely catch a beer.
I mean, you've got to write a speech, don't you? You've got to write a whole talk.
I mean, I have done that.
Yes. So I thought you were going to leave it to that Thursday night.
I was thinking about it, but I mean, look, the talk is mostly done, but I haven't yet run through it and timed it and practiced it and polished it. So, but you know me, I like to, unless I'm demoing something very specific, and especially given that this is kind of from experience and I'm talking, it's a case study, right? So I'm talking about an actual thing that really happened and, you know, talking about my learnings from that. It's kind of easier for me to go from notes and prompts and just talk about my experience.
Yeah.
So I've just got to make sure that I keep to time.
Yep.
So.
I mean, you've never had a problem with that.
Me or you?
Yeah. You.
No, I've never.
Had a problem keeping to
definitely,
time.
Definitely didn't get cut off in these.
Speaking of sticking to time.
Okay.
Should we jump in and actually.
Yes, one last thing.
The topic we were going to talk.
One last thing, though, which is that one of the stars of the story that I'll be telling is actually coming along next week.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So you'll get to find out more about that. And then back to your keeping to time. So, look, the problem is, as I've said before, I struggle with being concise. I do ramble. I waffle on a bit. This isn't something that I talk about often, and not because I'm ashamed of it or because I don't like to talk about it, but I just don't. I don't want to make a thing of it or play any cards or be defined by it or anything. But yeah, I am fairly severely neurodivergent. And I guess I kind of fit a bit of a stereotype in that regard.
What stereotypes are that?
The stereotype of the nerdy tech neurodivergent non-typical type.
Yeah, okay.
I'm trying my hand at a segue here. How's it going? How's it working out?
Yeah, it's kind of getting there. I see where you're going. But look, I don't know if you need to play that card, so to speak, right? And I guess if it has been a bit too cryptic, sort of, I guess you're talking about sort of that the Sheldon Cooper type stereotype, right?
Sheldon Cooper is an example of that archetype, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I've fallen under that banner myself in the past. I don't think I'm in that situation now, but yeah, absolutely. Where it's you're that stereotypical nerd, so to speak, that knows how to communicate with computers but not with people.
That's the problem, right? That's the archetype. So Sheldon Cooper, and this is the thing, is it's not just computers, right? So I call it the specialist myth, because it's not just computers, right? So it is very much a computer nerd stereotype or archetype even. So Sheldon Cooper is a physicist, not tech nerd. The one of the major examples I would go to would be Moss from the IT Crowd. Did you ever see that?
No.
Oh, it's good.
So, and that's where I don't fit the stereotype, right? I never saw Star Wars, Star Trek, any IT Crowd or any of that.
Right.
So,
well, there you go. So yeah, you don't fit it. And did you ever watch Elementary?
No, but that's the Sherlock Holmes one, right?
Yeah. It was quite good. Like at first it was very good. As with most mystery shows that run on too long, it stopped being about the mysteries and started being about just the geniuses who know everything and can just answer the questions with completely non-believable. So another answer, another example would be House.
Yeah.
Same thing. So obviously he's a doctor, right? But the same archetype, right? Brilliant, brilliant genius, but incapable of human connection.
Yeah.
So on and so forth. And it annoys me, right? And it annoys me as an archetype because I'm not the exception that proves the rule. Like, I definitely fall into that category. Like, I wouldn't say that I'm a, you know, a brilliant genius or anything, but obviously I'm a nerd and I'm into tech and I do like Star Wars and Star Trek and a few of those other things you said.
Superman.
Sorry?
Superman too. Can't leave that one out.
Superman?
Yeah.
I suppose I've seen it. Yeah, Superman, obviously. But I definitely break the mold, and it's not a mold. This is the thing. It's my problem is that it's bullshit, and we'll get to that, right? But I definitely break the stereotype in terms of communication. So when I'm talking intentionally, as in like in a business context, for example, I'm quite sort of well known as being a good communicator. And in fact, as I've argued before, I would suggest that my communication ability far outstrips my technical ability and has allowed me to achieve levels of seniority that I don't deserve from a technical perspective.
Yep.
In addition, as we have discussed on this show before, you know, we are not tunnel vision, single-minded focus on our tech and our capabilities and our skills. We always say that we're consultants first and engineers second. And what we do is we help to identify the problem and come up with solutions to the problem. And often, and as often as is necessary, those solutions are technology solutions. Equally often, they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot to unpack there. I really, and I don't know if I want to jump in just yet or let you keep going.
No, that's it. I've set the scene. So why don't you jump in? Why don't you take us back a step and paint a picture of what it is that we're talking about?
So yesterday, was it last night? You sent me an email to have a proofread of a post that you're about to post.
Yeah.
Right? Which covers this exact topic that we're talking about. That being that myth that the specialists out there are poor communicators and therefore not suitable leaders.
Yes. I'm not necessarily saying there's a causal relationship between those things, just that they are both part of that myth.
That's what I'm trying to get at. It's not, well, you're arguing that there is no causation between them, right? There shouldn't be a correlation there.
Well, there isn't a correlation there.
But there is a perceived correlation, and that's what the myth is.
Yes. But sorry, just to clarify, what I was saying just then was that I'm not saying that they are poor leaders because they are poor communicators, just that the myth is that they are poor leaders and poor communicators. Let me put it another way. The myth, if you think about the actual archetype, right, the myth is that people that are highly skilled, highly specialized in any field or discipline are poor communicators because they cannot perceive or cannot communicate on the level of other people. All they can do is talk in detail, ones and zeros, or, you know, very low level nuts and bolts about their particular specialty and are incapable of communicating to lay people.
Yep.
That's one aspect of the myth. The other aspect of the myth is that people that are highly specialized cannot lead or manage, not necessarily as a result of their poor communication. They're two different aspects of it.
Okay. Yep. It's interesting because I use my words wisely, the way I communicate this. So that it, because I feel that there may be a correlation between communication and leadership skills.
Yep. Don't disagree. Yep.
Right. I think, and, you know, again, this is, I guess, anecdotal, and this is my personal opinion. I don't know if there's any research to back that up, but if you're a poor communicator, I think you're going to struggle in a leadership position.
Yes. Look, so I didn't say that there's no correlation. I said that there isn't a causation. I said there isn't a causal relationship in terms of this myth. But just to touch on what you just said, that's a whole other topic. And as I've been saying for a while, and as we've touched on, I do want to spend some time or an episode diving into what the differences are between management and leadership. And I think this would be a good place to cover that. But I have my own taxonomy of leadership. And this is only my own taxonomy, right? It's not, you know, an official recognized classification system. But I kind of think that there are four kinds of leadership. There's inspirational, aspirational, motivational, and a fourth one that I've forgotten, but when I look up my notes and we talk about it another time, we can dive into it. And again, you know, depending on what, relatable, sorry, that's the fourth one. So relatable, aspirational, inspirational, and motivational. And depending on which one of those leadership styles or leadership scenarios we're talking about, communication is more or less important. But I feel like this is a whole other topic.
Yeah, no, I think so. And actually, just to take what the taxonomy you've just spoken about there, and to put it, I guess, into someone who is probably a bit more qualified in their terms, someone who's a bit more qualified, someone by the name of John Maxwell.
Yep.
He has defined his five levels of leadership.
Right.
Right. Level one is the lowest level, obviously, and that's a positional leadership.
Yep.
People do what you say because of the position you're in.
Yes, I am aware of this one, but keep going. Right. Yep.
Level two is the permission-based. So people will follow you because they want to. Right. It's based, and I'm just reading summaries here, but it's based on building that relationship and building trust and people having permission to follow you, right? Then there's the production level three, and they're following you because what you've done for the organization, how productive you've been, and they've been what you're capable and then what you can do for the organization.
Yep.
The next level, level four, is the people development, because you've helped someone personally. You've helped develop them.
Yep.
You're going to get a lot of leadership capital because you're helping individuals and they're going to want to follow you because of that. And then the top of that is the level five, the pinnacle.
Yeah.
And that's here. And that this summary here says people follow you because of who the leader is and what they represent. Right.
Yep.
And there's not a lot of people. And like that comes from a level of respect. There's not a lot of level five leaders out there, so to speak. But, you know, they're the people like, I guess you would think, say, Steve Jobs, who I know in your post you've mentioned, right?
Yes.
People, you know, they've gone through all the others. Like the position, yes, he was the boss. People followed him because they wanted to. They trusted him. They followed him because, you know, there's that story when he was kicked out of Apple and then the stock price was tanking and he comes back and the stock price starts going through the roof, right? He clearly did something for the organization.
Yeah, they also got a massive injection of capital from Microsoft, but that's, never mind.
But yeah. Like he then started to transcend his position itself and people would follow him and do what he was asking because of who he was and the respect that they gave him. So I guess that's just sort of that extra, more authoritative taxonomy on top of your four levels.
Yes, so mine aren't levels in that sense. They're not layered. They're not hierarchical in that sense. And it is a different taxonomy, but I can relate each of those to one or more of those levels. But look, that is a whole topic, and I would like to dive into it another time, unless we don't care about the specialist myth anymore and just want to talk about.
No, I think it's worth digging into because, I mean, I read your article and I thought yes.
It is, right? It is for some very good reasons. And if I just think back to my taxonomy, let me explain my taxonomy, right?
Yeah, go.
So let's talk about the relatable style, right? That's where you look at someone and you think that person is just like me. I can do what they do, right? That's where someone comes along and says, you can do this. This is what I'm doing. This is how you do it. You know, they make you feel like it's easy because they can do it, you can do it. That's the relatable style of leadership.
Yeah.
Then you've got the aspirational style. And again, these are not layered or hierarchical. These are just four different styles, right? The aspirational is when you look at someone and you want to do what they do. Not necessarily that you can or that you believe you can now, but that you want to try and you want to try and achieve what they've achieved.
Yeah.
You've got the, so what did I say? Relatable. Aspirational. Then you've got the inspirational, right?
Yeah.
And the inspirational is very similar to the aspirational in that you don't necessarily want to do what they've done, but they've inspired you to do more than what you're doing now, right? And then you've got the motivational, and that's kind of similar to the top two levels that you mentioned. The motivational is when someone brings out the best in you with intent. So, and this is, again, this is a big tangent, but this is something important that I often discuss, is this concept of motivation.
Yeah.
And I, the number of times I've been in interviews and someone has said to me, how do you motivate your team?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you don't. Motivation is intrinsic. It's 100% personal thing. Motivation is internal. It comes from inside, not outside. You don't motivate your team. You find what motivates them and then you provide it.
Yeah. No, I like that answer. I really, really like that answer. And it's one I'm going to steal.
Okay.
To start with. But no, I mean, that I guess comes down to, and I guess that's distilled in Dan Pink's Drive, right?
Yeah. Which I haven't read, but yeah.
You haven't read? But it's about defining that extrinsic motivation, or identifying the extrinsic motivators and the intrinsic motivators.
Yeah.
And it's about recognizing the fact that intrinsic motivators, those that make you want to do something because you just want to do them,
yeah,
are far more valuable than the extrinsic motivators.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which, you know, in a business sense is money.
Yep.
Bonuses, right? Money, bonuses. And it, you know, it goes to show money and bonuses can corrupt and can encourage the wrong behaviors.
Yeah.
I mean, it can encourage great behaviors, but at the same time, you're at a higher risk of encouraging behaviors you don't want and risky behavior you don't want because you're using the wrong motivators.
Yeah.
Which is exactly your point there, is you don't motivate your team.
Yes. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing is that extrinsic motivators are fickle and subject to change, as are intrinsic, but orders of magnitude less so.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, why did I suddenly decide that this was important to the other topic? And I'll tell you, it's because, with the exception of the motivational style that I mentioned, which does require, and again, like I get to this in the post, it does require dedicated commitment and study, because it's a skill that has to be learned, and especially that particular style of leadership or management. But the other three, the people best positioned for those kind of leaderships, those kind of leadership, are absolutely the peers, the specialists, the relatable, the inspirational, absolutely, and the aspirational. Arguably, the only people that can deliver those styles of leadership are the specialists. Well, no, actually, sorry. So inspirational could be, okay, so let's take inspirational out, because it could be a specialist, a different kind of specialist, different field, could be someone who's not a specialist. I would argue that it has its place, but let's just take it out. Relatable and aspirational. If you want to lead a team of specialists, to deliver those two styles, you must also be a specialist.
Well, you can't, obviously you cannot be relatable if you're not relatable.
Not in that context, no. Yeah,
no,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
To be relatable, you must be relatable.
Exactly. Yeah.
To call a spade, but
I mean, even if you take away all the other three and just leave that one, right?
Yeah.
That is a leadership style, and an important one, really, in many contexts. Unless you're really old school and you believe that a dictatorial, authoritative style is best, and you believe that you can lead by saying, "Don't do as I do as I say," and you know.
Well,
there are
four different types of leadership. None of those fall under that category.
No.
Well, I guess maybe relatable could, but no one's.
My point is that unless you are adopting that kind of leadership style, which is old school and people don't do that anymore for good reason, it doesn't work, then you need at least one of those four qualities.
Or more, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, this so far sounds like a very academic conversation and a lot of opinion, but the facts bear it out, right? And this is the problem. This is the thing that bothers me. And you know what? Like, it used to bother me a lot. It used to really frustrate me and annoy me, this myth and this persistent myth that just wouldn't die. And I, until, you know, recently, I thought it had died. Like, really, over the past 10 years, maybe more, no. Over the past 10 years or so, I've really seen this dying off. Over the past 5 years, I haven't encountered this at all, really. 5, 6, 7 years. And really over the past 10 years. So it's something that came up recently, and it kind of reminded me of it. And that's why I guess I wanted to bring it up. But it's something that used to really annoy me and doesn't so much anymore, because things have definitely changed and things have gotten better.
I definitely do agree. But it does make me think maybe it's still there, but it's just not as obvious.
Oh, no, absolutely. Like, this is the thing, is it hasn't gone away. That's the whole point. I guess I just stopped thinking about it and noticing it as much because it is not as big a thing as it was.
It's not, but I think it's subtle. Like, how many times have you been told that you're a good communicator? Because people would assume, based on your technical ability, that you were not going to be a good communicator, right? And I've had that, and not a lot of times, but I have had it a few times where people have commented that the way that I've been able to communicate or convey ideas, technical ideas, has been really helpful for them.
Yeah.
And it's not said with any bad intentions, and it's not said with any malice.
But it does reveal an unconscious bias.
It reveals an unconscious bias, but it's not a bias that I would have ever recognized until this exact moment when you have raised it. Right? That's how subtle it is.
Yeah.
There is a subtle expectation that I was not able to communicate these concepts. But I guess to me, it's never really bothered me, so I never really latched onto it.
Yeah. So I mean, I'll talk a bit more about the reasons that used to bother me a lot, and we can talk about some of the stories that I cover in that post. But I just want to, before we get into that, I just want to offer a counterpoint, which is that I do believe that things have changed. No, it's not a question of belief. Things have definitely changed. Like, I notice it in the tech space that we work in, even in, you know, within the context of the city that we're in, it's changed. Like, 10 years ago, things were very different to how they are now. Even in the context of customer interactions and that sort of thing. And this, I talk about this in the post as well, like sales first organizations now are letting their technical folks lead the sales engagement aspect.
That's part of the main contract that I picked up at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
They need the tech people in the sales.
Yeah. And it's the right thing to do. And again, the evidence bears it out. But, you know, going back 10 years, the sales folks were horrified at the idea of letting a technical person talk to a customer before the ink was dry on the contract, because the techs can't talk to them. They'll scare them off. Now, you know, something I didn't say in this post is an organization I was working in at the time, and I have mentioned this on this show before. It was an organization of between 100 and 200 people, at different times. And we were always at less, and this was a tech company. So what we sold was tech expertise, and you know, that's what we did. We were engineers, and at no time did the technical staff exceed 50%.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, you know, anyway, but what I was going to offer to the counterpoint about why I think things have changed, a client of mine that I'm working with recently got a new CEO, and it was an internal promotion from the head of IT. Not an IT company, not a tech company, but he's been there that long, and he was just respected as being the person that knows the business well enough and was the right person to put into that role.
Interesting, because usually those internals usually come from, I guess, the CFO or the COO.
Yep. Well, I mean, there's a whole thing about how that level of role is rarely an internal promotion.
Yeah.
And it's rarely, you know, rarely our tech, the tech folks afforded that level of respect. But again, that's not always the case. Like, there's a guy that I worked with about 10 years ago that was a CIO, and he was a very, very highly respected executive. Like, outside the context of IT or tech or anything, he was just a very, very well respected executive, and with good reason. The guy was fucking good, to be honest. But you know, he was a CIO. But so, you know, it's not the same world it was.
No, absolutely not. Gosh. This conversation now makes me want to jump back to my mate that we need to get on.
Yeah.
We need to get him on, because he was in a similar situation.
Right.
One day we'll get him on, hopefully. But yeah, went from his own startup in the medical space, got bought out, went on to CTO, CIO of the company that bought his original one out, I think it was. Then they had a product that they ended up spinning off. He became CEO of that. Took that one, got that sold to like VC, then sold to sold once or twice more.
But those are tech companies.
It was a tech company.
And by no means am I diminishing his accomplishment. I'm just saying, you know, and that is incredible. But in this example, it's just so rare to see someone from in a non-tech company, someone from tech be promoted to that level of leadership. It's incredible.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I know your friend you're talking about, and I'm really keen for you to get him on as well.
No, just keep nothing. He's over in the UK at the moment. Just nothing. I keep forgetting about it. When we go and line him up, I just keep forgetting.
So, yeah, so I guess, you know, I keep talking about how things were and how things have changed. And I want to give some examples because it is something that used to bother me a lot. And I've been saying that and I haven't explained probably why. So let me explain why. Right, I've mentioned some sales-driven organizations, and I mentioned one where I worked where there was, you know, the engineering staff were less than 50% and the sales folks wouldn't let people talk to customers. And I've got to tell you, right, a lot of those engagements, well, okay, so first of all, a lot of the pre-sales engagements were shit and we lost so much business. And we lost business because we've even lost business where I had been in a conversation with a client and someone had found out that I'd been part of that conversation and they'd pulled me out and then the deal fell through. Like, you know, because you build up trust and you build up credibility talking with a client because you're talking about the technology and they know what they come to understand that you know what you're talking about. And then there's the rug pull and they're left with smooth talking sales folks who don't know shit, you know.
And who are going, because again, back to the extrinsic motivators, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They're going to make these sales. They're going to get their commission. They're going to be looking for a new job in 6 months' time anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's a project manager I spoke about in this post as well. The classic, I don't know. I don't want to know. Like, I'm not interested in the technology. I just want shit to get done. It's not whatever. Yeah. Anyway, an interesting tale about this particular organization was that, you know, this isn't just me having a gripe here, right? Again, evidence bears this out. And the evidence bears it out in the deals that we lost, the customers that we lost after, you know, delivery or during delivery, so on and so forth. But I think that the best indictment of this approach in my mind was when they brought in a new CEO or general manager, and they brought him in to bring about some transformation and, you know, get a whole bunch of things back on track. And the first thing that he did, well, I mean, you know, he spent a few weeks kind of observing and talking and taking notes. And then he presented his plan and his strategy. And this is what we're going to do to turn things around. First thing he did was take a skills audit, right? And what he presented back to the organization was that he said, we got to sell what's on the truck, right? And
I've mentioned this in the past.
Yeah. He said, I've noticed that our sales team don't know what's on the truck. They're going out and they're selling blind and they're selling, you know, promises and wishes, right? You know, and they're coming back and they're fighting tooth and nail to secure deals and they're the wrong deals. And, you know, if we spent less time going after the things that we actually can't then deliver and then scrambling to deliver a port, somehow get something over the line and then never work with that customer again, if we redirected that effort into focusing on the things that we can actually do and deliver, if we sell what's on the truck, we'll be better off. So, you know, and again, this is a non-tech, right? This is someone that had a long career in tech, without being technical, because he put in the time to figure out the parts of it that he needed to figure out.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I said, it's kind of completely external to my own observations here. I feel like that's pretty much a pretty good indictment of the situation as it was before and fairly good evidence of the points that I've been trying to make. So the post is, I feel like the post has some good points and it feels like, you know, I feel like I say some things that are important. Like, you know, I mentioned that literally the very existence of DDD refutes this myth, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's quite difficult to design a solution with the domain in the middle if you cannot speak to the domain experts and get what's in their brain into the solution.
Yeah. Now, what I want you to do is hold up your fingers and count on them for me. How many non-technical folks you know that are DDD consultants?
None.
Yeah. So, yeah, like I feel like I make some good points here, but I will also admit that it is a bit of a rant. It is definitely one of those Matt gets angry about shit things. Because there are a few stories in there that you know, clearly, in fact, one of them I describe as living rent-free in my head ever since. Yeah. So
now, I wonder if the rant is coming from, and I think I know the answer, but the rant is coming from a place of frustration.
Is that not where they all come from?
Yeah, I realize that when I say it. Okay. I wonder if the article is coming from a place of frustration.
Yeah.
Right? Which is why it's coming across as ranty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As in, we've all worked for leaders, project managers, delivery managers, whatever you want to call them in any role, on different teams that are not technical.
Yep.
And I know I've had my share of successful projects with non-technical leaders on there.
Yes.
So, again, I think it comes down to, yes, there are frustrations here because of lived experience.
Yep.
And it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Yep.
Like, not every non-tech leader is bad. And
yep, agreed. Yep.
And having a tech background does not necessarily make you a good leader.
Yep.
So to speak, you know, it's what is a good leader is also quite a tough topic to distill.
Yeah.
But I think you can get the best of both worlds. I think there's, just trying to find the right words here. I guess I'm trying to say, I don't think you have to be technical. And you do actually, now that I'm thinking about it, you do highlight this in the article. You don't have to be technical, but, and I think there's a big but.
Yeah.
Right. You still need to be relatable. You still need to be aspirational. You still need to be inspirational. You still need to be motivational.
Yeah.
Right? And how do they do that? If you're non-technical, how would you do that?
Yeah.
Well, the simple answer there is give a shit.
Yes.
About the technology.
Yes.
Right. Give a shit about what you're doing, what the team is doing.
Yeah.
You may not. And
which,
you know,
one might argue is mutually exclusive with the phrase, I don't know, I don't want to know.
Yes. Absolutely. And
yeah.
Look, I've heard, I don't know who it's attributed to, but like there's that quote sort of saying, you don't want to be the smartest person in the room. Like as a leader, you don't want to be the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
Right. So by that definition, you don't want to be the absolute specialist because you want someone else that understands the technology way better than you.
Yeah. But,
and the but there is, you still need to give a shit about what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you still need to be able to articulate what they're doing and you still need to be able to just want to know more. You want Absolutely. To be relatable to them.
Absolutely. 100%. So I'll come back to that because it's kind of what you touched on at the start of that is really the core premise of my whole thing here. But I just want to touch on what you said at the end there, which is that if you're the leader, you don't want to be the smartest one. And this was a major problem that faced the tech sector for a long time. And I can't remember who it was. Was it maybe, again, Brandon Minnick, who was telling us about this? Oh, because I think he was talking about the Xamarin team, actually. But this was why the staff engineer position was created. Yep. Because the only pathway for promotion and career progression was management and leadership. And that meant that the best engineers were getting made hands off.
Yes.
And that's hugely damaging to the team, for a product team. But yeah, so getting back to what you said at the start there, right? And I think you touched on, so again, like, you know, this post is here. It's up. I haven't shared it and I will. And people can read it if they want. And they can look at the different rants and so on and so forth. But the core point that I'm making here, which you also just made, is that management and leadership are skills that have to be learned, right? Yeah. And if you come from a hands-on background, whether it's tech, whether it's, you know, I give other examples here as well. Yeah, like I said in the beginning, when we're talking about house and whoever else, like if it's medical, if it's science, if it's aviation, if it's teaching, doesn't matter. If you're a highly skilled expert and you want to move into a leadership position, that's not your skill. You have to learn that skill. And mm-hmm. the same thing works the other way. Is if you are someone with a leadership background and just a leadership background, and you want to move into leading a team of specialists, you have to put in the time and effort to learn the fundamentals of that specialty. You don't have to be an expert. That's, you have a team of experts to be the experts, but you do have to understand the fundamentals.
Yep.
You have to give a shit, like you said, and you have to give a shit about the people. You know, I'll tell you something interesting. Back in my misspent youth, when I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. I was I was exploring the idea of a career in the military, and this is something that I've revisited on more than one occasion. It's a bloody stupid idea, really, for several reasons, but there are certain aspects of it that hold a certain appeal to me. And I remember talking with some soldiers at a, this was the UK, this was in the UK at the time, so it was the British Armed Forces. And I was talking to a group of soldiers, and I was at a career fair, and I was saying, look, I'm thinking of dropping out of college, you know, I don't like it, I don't like education, blah, 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 I don't want to go to uni. And they were saying, if you finish your A-levels, even better if you finish a degree, but even if you finish your A-levels, you can go straight to Sandhurst Military Academy,
mm-hmm.
and you can literally enter as an officer, right?
Yeah.
So they're like, I know that you see this as an exit strategy for your A-levels, you don't want to finish, but finish your A-levels. And if you still want to do it, come and do it, because it's a much better opportunity.
Yeah.
And I said to them, and I was naive, I didn't have any idea how it worked back then. And I said, I didn't know that literally career officers join the armed forces as officers, you know.
Yeah.
And I said to them, I don't understand. How could I possibly lead a group of subordinates without the experience that they have?
Yep.
And they said to me, you're already off to a good start, because the best officers are the ones that acknowledge that, and they listen to their team and ask for their advice.
Yep.
They make the decision, the buck stops with them, but they make the decisions based on collaborative. And, you know, like, this is the thing, is like I said earlier, you know, there's different styles of leadership, and that, and the military, and we've spoken about this before as well. The military is one of those rare scenarios where you do need that authoritative style. You do need the do as I say, not do as I do. You do need the, you can't question the chain of command, because lives are at stake, right? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard otherwise in other podcasts I've listened to. I have heard basically saying that that is the stereotype, but by no means does that actually get the results.
Well, I mean, I was going to sort of close the loop on that.
Sorry.
One. Right. So this is what I'm saying, and this is what these soldiers were saying to me, right? And it kind of bears out. And yes, it's like the evidence and the stories from the people that have actually lived that experience bear it out as well, which is that, yes, that is the stereotype. And the reality is that the officers do have the authority and the command, and there is a chain of command, and it does have to be obeyed. However, as these folks were saying to me, the best officers and the ones that get the best results are the ones that lead collaboratively with their team. And they talk to their team, they get input from them, they get advice from them, they make decisions collaboratively. There are other times when they have to say, this is the decision and this is what we're doing, and everyone has to go along with it, whether they agree with it or not. But they make those decisions with input and advice from the experts, from the specialists, from the ones with that experience.
Yes, there's a lot there, right? I mean, again, it comes back to your four leadership traits, right? Relatable, aspirational, inspirational, motivational.
Yeah.
But if you've got those, you don't need to say, do this because I said so.
No, no. Ideally, you never have to.
No, because like you're building up that rapport.
Yeah. Now. And if you've done that successfully, even on the occasions when the team do disagree with you, they're not going to question you.
This is the next point. And now, so you've done what I was talking about. Now, this is the idea of leadership capital.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right? Whereby you've done all these other things, you've become relatable, aspirational, inspirational, motivational, right? You've done the best for your team. You've communicated well with them. You've taken all their feedback. You've used all their information. You've built them on, taken them with you through this, and I don't want to use the word journey, but you've taken them through this experience and you're growing with them, right?
Yeah.
You're, all of that, you're building leadership capital. You're going to the bank with that capital and you're sticking it in there.
Yeah.
Right? You're building up a massive bank account.
Yeah.
Now, you do need to be aware, every time you put your foot down and say, guys, we need to do this, I know it doesn't, you know, I don't know you don't agree with it, but we're doing this.
You're drawing down on that.
You're drawing down on that leadership capital.
Yeah.
And if that you don't have enough in that balance, they're going to turn around to you and just go, yeah, no, we're not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or they're going to say, yes, we'll do it. And they're going to do a bad job, or they're going to resent you for it.
Yeah.
And then you're going to go into negative balance.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to bring that back to kind of the core premise that I was getting at here. If you are, as I said, right, if you are a leader who wants to lead a team of specialists and you are not someone that's come from the background of that specialty, You need to invest the time and effort in learning the fundamentals of that specialty. There is no getting around that. And as you said, we've both led successful projects or successful teams that have been led by people not from that specialist background. And in all of those circumstances, I guarantee you, these people have put in the time and effort to learn the fundamentals.
Absolutely.
Of that specialty. Because as you said, they need to give a shit. But they don't just need to give a shit about the specialty, the tech. They need to give a shit about the people as well. Because as we just talked through with that, the example of the military and the leadership capital, you have to listen to them, not just because you give a shit about the technology, but because you respect their opinions. And there is such a thing as dysfunctional teams, and dysfunction can come from many different places. And sometimes there are people on the team whose opinions you don't respect.
Mm-hmm.
But it still behooves you to give them the time to voice those opinions, and you still need to evaluate them and take them seriously. Because, well, again, I was going to say, because it builds the capital and it presents the right message and the right tone to the team. Of course, again, like, there are outlier scenarios where you may need to actually make a show of shutting down bullshit. But the example you always say is the behavior that you walk past is the behavior you endorse.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I think it's even more simple than that, right? If you're working on a team, if someone is, to use, for lack of a better term, if someone is a dickhead on that team,
yeah,
everyone knows it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So if you, and as a leader, everything you do is quite transparent.
Yeah.
Right. Everyone sees what's happening. So I guess the point I'm trying to make here is, if you are in a situation where you might need to shut that person down, you may not be burning as much leadership capital in that situation than you realize, than you think you are.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you may be burning it by not doing it, depending.
You may,
depending on the situation.
I guess that's the point you're making there. But I think the thing is that, like, you're on a team. Everyone can see what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone knows what everyone's personalities are like.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's that, if you have to be too precious about that.
No. I mean, it's probably not that big a deal. I don't know. And it's very situational. But anyway, I just want to be very clear about something here as well, because I did say that the reverse is also true. And I think it's important to be clear that I do have a problem with the myth that, highly specialized individuals cannot be good leaders. I take exception to that. But I'm not saying that they are by default good leaders, because that's also completely untrue. What I'm saying is that there is no correlation between the two. Because, as I said, if you are someone who's not a specialist and you want to lead a team of specialists, you have to learn the specialty. If you are someone who is a specialist without that leadership or management experience, you have to put in the hard yards to learn that as well. Because it is equally a set of skills. And the more you develop those skills, the better you get at it. And yeah, it's, there are people that just are not good leaders, and there are people that are not good leaders from technical backgrounds, from non-technical backgrounds. There are people that are great leaders from technical backgrounds, from non-technical backgrounds. It comes down to the individual. It comes down to aptitude, and also aptitude can be learned, right? So you may have a particular predisposition to something based on, this is a whole separate thing about, is talent real? And the evidence, the science is that yes, talent is real, but it's far less important than practice. But that's a whole other thing. But the point is, whether you have a predisposition to it or not, whether you have an aptitude, that aptitude can be learned, the skill can be learned. If you want to be a leader of specialists, you need to have the leadership and the specialty. Whichever one of those two you don't have, even if it's both, if you really want it that badly, you've got to learn the other one. Yeah. And the capability of being a good leader, the good leader, bad leader thing, just doesn't correlate. There isn't a correlation between people that are highly specialized, highly technical, highly focused individuals and people that are bad leaders or good leaders. It's down to the individual. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. Was that a showstopper? Was that a mic drop? Did I?
No.
Did I kill the conversation?
Look, again, I can't, and I'm not disagreeing with anything you've said there. I guess it's not something that's really jumped on my radar. And like we said earlier, maybe it's because it's just not as prevalent and not as obvious these days.
Yeah. Yeah. And, this is the thing, is it's not something that really bothers me anymore, but there was something that reminded me of it. And this post and this discussion is something I've been thinking about for decades, and I've never done it. and I've just kind of repressed it and then got over it and then forgot all about it. And I guess now, because it feels like it is in the past, I feel much safer talking about it, I guess, which is why I kind of opened that floodgate and brain dumped this post.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I think too, I mean, you and I have been in the consulting space now for, 5, 6 years? I can't even remember now. 9, 8?
Yeah, I was going to say longer, a lot longer than that.
Closer to 10. And look, I know the process with getting into SSW where we both met.
Yeah.
There's a big emphasis on communication.
Yeah.
Because you are client facing.
Yeah. Well, yes, you have to pass a communication test before you even get to do a tech test.
That's right. So I wonder too if some of our recent experience and exposure is based on the fact that we have been in the consulting side of tech, whereby more often than not, we are surrounded by people who can communicate, whose job is to communicate as much as it is to be technical.
Yeah.
Which means then that it's going to be less likely for us to come across those stereotypes again.
Maybe, but I mean, I would say I've probably got about 10 years experience in consulting and about an equal amount of experience professionally, not in consulting, and then much more experience not in consulting in kind of non-professional roles, like, you know, working the bar and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, and you know, you are correct. And, you know, we are surrounded by and exposed to people that clearly falsify the stereotype within our sphere of professional experience, like, absolutely. But I do see it in internal roles as well, and in internal culture as well. And I think it's important to point out that it's not unique to tech.
No.
But in the professional space, in the corporate space, it is much more prevalent in tech than in other fields. The examples I give in my blog post are, you're never going to hire a non-medico to be your head of surgery, right?
Yeah.
You know, you never get someone who would rock up to an interview saying, "Oh, I'm not an accountant, but I can manage the fuck out of a finance department." And my mum, who read this blog post, responded with, she called that out as a quote and said, "Tell that to literally every chancellor of the Exchequer that we've ever had." That's a fair point. I'm sorry, in case you don't know, that's in the UK, that's the equivalent of the treasurer, I guess.
Ah, there you go. Yep.
That's a whole different kettle of fish.
So key takeaways for me. One, just to be aware of the myths and that are around. Like, yes, we've been focusing specifically on again, technical people not being able to lead or communicate clearly, which is a dangerous myth. But
yep.
And as I said before, maybe it's a subconscious bias, maybe it's a subtle bias that we all have in us. But I think that goes well beyond just this one bias, this one myth we're talking about.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's, I guess, a good time just to take a step back and reflect. Another key takeaway to me is just give a shit.
Yeah.
Give a shit about what you're doing.
Yeah.
Be that if you are going down that leadership, that management path, give a shit about your team. Give a shit about what they're doing, the specialties that they need. I don't want to keep harping on the technical aspect and the technical skills, but their specialties. Understand the lingo. Understand the ubiquitous language that's going on in that team.
Yeah.
At a bare minimum.
Yeah. Right?
At a bare minimum, understand what they're talking about. I really do like your four styles of leadership, or the four aspects, the relatable, aspirational, inspirational, motivational.
Yeah.
I think it's a great way to summarize, like I said, summarize even those five levels of leadership almost. Not that there's an exact correlation, but there are
similarities.
There's overlap and similarities, absolutely. Look, I forgot about those five levels of leadership until you started speaking about this, and then that reminded me. And having that as a recent reminder is good too, those separate five levels.
Hmm. You also said you're going to steal my. You're also going to steal my answer to the "how do you motivate your team" question.
Well, two aspects to that. One, I'm going to steal that answer, but two, I'm going to be looking for the answer when I'm hiring too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Right. And then it'll be hard to find something that actually aligns that could actually top that one.
Are you saying that you are going to deliberately try and trip up candidates with a trick question?
No. It's a benchmark.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the high watermark.
Right. Yeah.
So then you can just measure everyone else from there.
It's the aspirational benchmark. So, yeah, I think you're right. And I think, you know, we have spoken about this one specific thing, but, and we've mentioned this before as well, like it is important to be aware as much as possible of your unconscious biases. And, you know, I'm not some super woke, super aware, you know, person that's got some amazing skill at being able to, we've spoken about golden hammers. We've spoken about unconscious biases before. I've spoken about how I reread that book every year or so, because I do need the reminder, you know, and it's not about breaking free of those unconscious biases, because I don't think that's possible. Maybe it's possible over time, but being aware of them is important. And I think, I don't think there's anything wrong with catching yourself thinking something which you kind of realize is wrong and is as a result of an unconscious bias. As long as you are capable of being aware of it, adjusting your thinking and not acting on your initial instinctive response, I guess.
But no, I mean, the simple fact is, if we want to improve, we need to recognize these biases.
Yeah.
And like you said, you may not conquer them, you may not stop them, but the least you can do is recognize them.
Yeah.
Recognize your reaction to them.
Yeah.
And learn from that.
Yeah.
And adjust. So next time it happens. And
you can't take the second step without the first.
No.
I have to say, this conversation definitely didn't go in, it went in directions I wasn't expecting, and I liked it.
Yeah. So no.
Yeah. Now the bar staff, not so much. I think we've outstayed our welcome, and I think they're calling last orders.
I think I agree there, Matt. I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
That was awesome. Fun. I like that one.
And you know what's good is we actually were both Beer Driven Devs this evening. It's been a while.
It's been a while.